Psalm 90. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You return man to the dust and say, "Return, you children of men." For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a night watch in the night time. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. Let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands among us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Deuteronomy 34. Then Moses climbed Mount Nebo from the plains of Moab to the top of Pisgah, across from Jericho. There the Lord showed him the whole land and said to him, "This is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Jacob, when I said, 'I will give it to your descendants.' I have let you see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over into it." And Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, as the Lord had said. He was buried there, but to this day no one knows where his grave is. Moses was 120 years old when he died, yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. The Israelites grieved for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days, until the time of weeping and mourning was over. Now Joshua, son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid his hands on him. So the Israelites listened to him and did what the Lord had commanded Moses. Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all those signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his officials and to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. Matthew 22. When the Pharisees heard that he silenced the Sadducees, they came together. One of them, who was a lawyer, tested him by asking, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." A spirituality of work. Work is my gift to the world. It is my social fruitfulness. It ties me to my neighbor and binds me to the future. A spirituality of work is based on a heightened sense of sacramentality, of the idea that everything that is holy, and that our hands consecrate it to the service of God. When we grow radishes in a small container in a city apartment, we participate in creation. When we sweep the street in front of a house, we bring new order to the universe. When we repair what has been broken or paint what is old, or give away what we have earned that is above and beyond our own sustenance, we stoop down and scoop up the earth and breathe into it new life again. When we compost garbage and recycle cans, when we clean a room and put coasters under glasses, when we care for everything we touch and touch it reverently, we become creators of a new universe. Then we sanctify our work, and our work sanctifies us. A spirituality of work puts us in touch with our own creativity. Work enables us to put our personal stamp of approval, our own watermark, the autograph of our souls, on the development of the world. In fact, to do less is to do nothing at all. We hear with our hearts and our minds.
Respond with our hearts and our hands. If you've read this week's e-news or heard me talk before, you'll know that I love the stories of Moses. What a chaotic and eventful life he had. I thought I knew the story well, but I'd like to share some insights inspired by Jewish writers commenting on their sacred texts about their greatest prophet. I think we can see that Moses took a while, but he finally learned that it matters what we do. This phrase is from some ideas of how Unitarian Universalist kids could talk about their church, I think aimed particularly at children whose friends may be very conservative. And it works in this faith community too. So if asked, we might say, I go to a church where people have open minds, loving hearts, and hands that are ready to help. Or we believe it's a blessing to be born, and it matters what we do. What we know about God is a piece of the truth. We let the beauty we love be what we do, and we don't have to do it alone. And if we're asked what we believe, we might say, we believe in asking good questions, and then ask about their beliefs and listen. Establish the work of our hands, prayed Moses in Psalm 90. Over 4,000 years ago, Semitic people started crossing the deserts from Palestine into Egypt. Some came as traders and immigrants. Others were prisoners of war, and yet others were sold into slavery by their own people. We enter Moses' story when Egypt's Pharaoh was worried the enslaved Hebrew minority's population was increasing. His plan to weaken them through harsh rule and forced labour had the opposite effect. The more they were oppressed, the more they increased and spread out. Concerned they might ally themselves with Egypt's enemies, he ordered the Israelite midwives to kill all male babies at birth. Moses was born during this time. His mother Jochebed hides him in a reed basket in the River Nile with sister Miriam to keep watch. And miraculously, he's rescued by the king's daughter and raised in the palace. That's quite a rags-to-riches story, and it's just the beginning. But let's not forget the midwives. When he discovers they've disobeyed them and not killed the male babies, they tell the king it's because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptians. They are vigorous. Before the midwife can come to them, they've given birth. One Jewish rabbi says, in their refusal to obey Pharaoh, the midwives assume a key role in the collective birthing of the people of Israel. And next come the missing years. Do you hear the echo of Moses' life in the way stories were told about Jesus? By people who believed he was the greatest prophet, the deliverer of their people, the man of God. Whatever position Moses attained through his palace upbringing, and whatever challenges to his identity, it doesn't save him from the wrath of Pharaoh. Think about it for a while. Think about the challenges for Maori children taken from their mothers and fostered by Pākehā. Think of black children adopted by people with a white saviour attitude, detaching them from their people and culture. Think of the delicate balance Pacifica kids face in a Eurocentric education system that expects impudent behaviour from them, making eye contact, questioning their teachers, valuing individual achievement over community learning. Imagine being a fourth generation Chinese Kiwi from a working class family in university tutorials with wealthy international students and being no good at maths. Imagine being discovered by royalty and adopted into the palace with its peculiar customs and bizarre religious rituals. Over the years, becoming highly educated and successful, looking and dressing just like the other royals with all that implicit authority. Imagine learning that your nurse and childminder, a badly dressed woman with an estuary accent, a despised Hebrew slave, is your birth mother. Imagine watching her disguise her innate intelligence from the entitled lesser royals she works beside. See them treat her with contempt and suspicion. Imagining an adolescent Moses in that situation, we begin to understand his churning emotions, his resentment at missing out on a normal family life, his shame at the ignorance and passivity of his enslaved kinsmen, his expectation of deference to a member of the royal household. He despises their failure to manage on their pitiful income, their propensity to breed like rabbits, and their live for the moment, don't expect your life to be better than this attitude. He's uneasy with their politeness to strangers and their rowdy family parties, envying the hospitality, but expecting to be waited on like a prince. Imagine finding that his position as foster grandson of the king doesn't protect him when he kills an Egyptian taskmaster who's beating a Hebrew slave. How dare he? Pharaoh wants Moses executed. Imagine his encounter with two scrapping Hebrews. He thinks he's in a position to help, but they resent his intervention and ask him if he'll kill them in a temper, like the Egyptian, and try to bury their bodies in the sand. What does he know with his fancy clothes and posh accent? They're real men. They're sorting things out with their fists, and they don't want his anger on their behalf or his high-handed interference. So Moses flees from Egypt all the way to Midian, leaving behind both birth and foster families. While stopped at a well to rest and drink, he defends a priest's daughters who are being harassed by other shepherds. When their father asks why they're home earlier than usual, they say, an Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock. Where is he then? Their father asks. Why did you leave him there? Invite him for supper to break bread. It's a great story, and of course Moses marries one of the daughters, Zipporah, and settles in to work as a shepherd for his father-in-law. As a Midianite priest and a landowner, maybe his father-in-law helps Moses integrate the heritage of his own people with his higher education and assumption of authority. We might wonder how well he works with his wife's sisters who've been managing the flocks on their own. Does he expect to become the farm manager? Or is he content with his role in the community of drawing water and herding animals? And one day, Moses decides to investigate a tree that seems unnatural, on fire but not burning up. Rabbi Shimon Felix suggests that during this time, Moses develops his leadership skills, his ability to see beyond his narrow struggles and his role as a liberator. It makes more sense, he writes, to see this not as a pyrotechnics display put on by God to impress Moses and get his attention, but rather as a final, ultimate step taken by Moses, the final stage in his evolution and growth as a person and a leader. So Moses discovers that here in the foreign land of Midian, he's on holy ground. And he comes to realize his mission. He must return to Egypt and free his people. But Moses protests. Nobody will listen to him. They won't take him seriously. This is our greatest fear, that those we deeply love and care about won't ever really get us, says Rabbi Michelle Masagia. Next, Moses admits his and our second fear. I don't have the skills to make a difference in the world. Who am I to take a leadership position? Third time, he protests. What Moses is really expressing is our third deep fear, writes Rabbi Michelle. When put to the test, I don't think I can actually do what others want of me. I'm scared I won't fulfill my destiny, be the person I'm meant to be, change for the better, or even live up to my own hopes and dreams for myself. But there's a solution. Ask for help. Aaron, Moses' brother, will be right there with him. That's when Moses overcomes his fears and stops making excuses. So begins the heart-rending story of liberation and rebellion we know as the Exodus. Jubilation when Pharaoh and his chariots drown in the Red Sea. Sister Miriam's triumphant dance with the other women. The pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. Water cascading from a rock because Moses lost his temper again and struck it. Miraculous food appearing. The Ten Commandments inspired on Mount Sinai. But Moses' troubles aren't over. His flock of ex-slaves might not be used to making their own decisions, but they don't want to take orders either. And yes, Moses was the liberator, but they resent his assumption that he knows God's will, and they still see him as a class traitor who's moved away and mixed with different sorts of people. Aaron and Miriam understand them. They recall that while they gathered straw to make mud bricks, Moses grew up in palatial luxury. Throughout antiquity, Egypt was known as the breadbasket of the world, writes archaeologist Philippe Bostrom. The annual flooding of the Nile produced rich harvests, and when famine hit the neighbouring lands, starving peoples often made their way to the fruitful soils of Egypt. The liberated Hebrews yearned for fatted calves and quail and sweetmeats instead of manna. The generation born in the desert think of Egypt with nostalgia and berate Moses for bringing them to this desolation. Time and again they rebel. While Moses communes with God on the mountain, they ask Aaron to help them make a golden calf to represent their deity since Moses has disappeared. And eventually, at 120 years of age, clear-sighted and healthy, Deuteronomy tells us, Moses is taken once more to the mountaintop and shown the land of promise. But he dies there in Moab, never to see the covenant fulfilled. And yet, between sorting out intertribal rivalries and making sure only the purest lambs were used for sacrifices, facing his family's disapproval of his mixed-race marriage, completing the ornate tabernacle in the wilderness, keeping an eye out for that pillar of cloud and fire, Moses has the time and energy to write this prayer. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it has passed, and as a watch in the night. Let thy work appear unto thy servants, and thy glory unto their children. And let the beauty of the Lord God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it. Perhaps Moses understood that his life's work was complete, and it was up to others to continue it. Perhaps he took a long-term view. 100 years or 1,000 are like a day gone by, or like the night watch. It seems long, but how quickly it is done. Deuteronomy is the book of the Torah whose law and theology most directly shaped later Judaism. It anticipates a society pursuing justice and righteousness, living in harmony with God and enjoying his bounty. But the promise of this land is conditional. Israel's welfare depends on maintaining a society but governed by God's social and religious laws. The Torah's humanitarianism is most developed in Deuteronomy's concern for the welfare of the poor and disadvantaged. By Jesus' time, much of the law involved what work you could and couldn't do, who you could and couldn't work with, and when, how particular tasks were to be done, down to the last detail. Jesus was familiar with the Torah and its greatest prophet, Moses. We heard last week about the scribes and Pharisees trying to trick Jesus with questions about paying tribute to Caesar. In today's reading, they're back with questions about the law. But there's more to the Torah than rules and regulations. So Jesus answers, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbour as yourself." This is Deuteronomy's concern for the welfare of the poor and disadvantaged in action. That sounds relatively simple, doesn't it? Provided, of course, you've learned to love yourself, to love that of you which is God, to see and love the God in your neighbours, even the noisy ones, the messy ones, the ones who play their music too loud or mow their lawns too early, the neighbours who whine a lot, the incessant writers to the editor, the ones we wish would get a life, the doomsayers and gloom merchants, the ones who try to take a shine out of other people's achievements, those neighbours. Love them with all our hearts and with all our souls and with all our minds. That's how we establish the work of our hands. Or maybe we love through our actions first, and faith that our hearts will catch up. Because in these ways, our enterprise is favoured and the divine beauty shines in us. I can't take credit for the Unitarian Universalist passage that the children said, but I think that it's a great one. And you might like to say it with me. It's a blessing we are born, and it matters what we do. What we know about God is a piece of the truth. We let the beauty we love be what we do, and we don't have to do it alone. Blessed be the work of our hands.